Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has called community water fluoridation one of the great public health achievements of the 20th century. But critics say fluoridated water is not as safe and not as effective as we've been led to believe. We'll find out why water fluoridation is still so controversial. But first, WPSU's Kate Lau Schaffner talks with Susan Basso, Penn State's Vice President of Human Resources, about the university's new wellness initiative and recent changes to employee health insurance benefits.
Susan Basso, thank you for talking with me.
Thank you, Kate. I appreciate the interview.
Penn State recently rolled out a wellness plan called the Take Care of Your Health Initiative. Employees must participate or face a $100 per month surcharge. Why is Penn State making these changes?
Well, largely because we have healthcare costs that are careening out of control. We have a $217 million medical spend, and it is not viable for us to pass those costs on to our students or their families in any way. So we really need to think about how we can control those costs, and this was the measure that we're putting in place.
Explain specifically how this will save the university money, and when will these savings begin?
Well, the reality is that healthier employees cost the university less in terms of our healthcare spend. So it does remain to be seen at this point how soon we will start to realize any kind of savings or benefit, but we do know that healthier employees will cost us less, and hopefully we'll be able to pass those savings on to employees in the future.
So this is a long-term plan with maybe a longer-term return?
It is. It's definitely a journey to wellness. I mean, we want to get our employees healthier, and we're going to do everything we can to ensure that that happens.
How is this going to save money in the short term?
Sure. Well, in the short term, I was given a charge by the president of the university, and that very specific charge was that I needed to hold this year's cost increase to CPI plus 2, which is about 5%. If we would have been continuing on the same trajectory that we had been on, we would be looking at approximately a 14% increase in cost. So we've already had the actuarial analysis done, and we know that this plan will help us meet that objective of 5%.
Do you expect a significant number of people to opt out? Are you projecting money coming back that way?
Well, we certainly know that there are employees that will choose not to participate. And frankly, you know, we feel the beauty of our plan is that it does afford employees that it's their choice. They can control their own financial destiny and make decisions based on the information that we provide. We really, at this point, are just projecting what might happen, but we're hoping that lots of employees will participate because it's for their own betterment. We already know that participation is incredibly high. Penn State has actually, for a decade or more, been very aggressive and has had a very robust wellness program, but it's been voluntary. Voluntary participation has not yielded very active participation and has not done anything to bend the institutional cost curve at all. But in the last 4 days, we have seen probably 2 to 3 times the participation that we've had in comparison to the last decade.
How would you respond to those who say Penn State leadership is not being transparent in this matter?
I would say that that's largely false. We did consult with a number of important constituencies. We certainly could argue about whether consultation was enough, but we certainly did meet with the Faculty Senate Benefits Committee on at least 3 separate occasions, made very robust presentations. We met with the University Staff Advisory Council, and we met with the Faculty Joint Committee on Insurance and Benefits, and we recognize and know that this is a very important part of shared governance at Penn State, and we do believe that we consulted with them appropriately.
Why do you think so many people feel like they've been caught off guard?
Well, I think whenever you put in place a program that affects people's potentially could affect people's financial situation, it's very difficult for individuals. This has not been an easy thing for me to roll out. But I know that this was an important business decision, and it gets to the directive and meets the objective that the president has set for me.
We ask listeners to submit questions on Facebook, Twitter, or by email. We receive dozens and dozens of questions. From Dennis via Facebook, what good scientific evidence indicates any of these actions, completing an assessment, getting a physical, or getting a biometric screening, lead to better health or lower costs?
Well, we certainly have looked at lots of research. Our insurance partner, Highmark, obviously has been involved in a lot of research in this area. They've actually done this almost very specific program within their own organization. We've talked with lots of experts. We're certainly always interested in talking with our own in-house expertise, and would welcome any time any of our faculty in the research space, particularly in this arena, coming to the table to talk with us about this challenge.
You've instituted a surcharge for smokers. How does Penn State identify who is a smoker?
It's very much an honor system, and you know, like any employer, we have every reason to expect that our employees of the highest caliber of honesty and integrity, and that they would in fact disclose to us whether or not they were a smoker or a tobacco user. And really, we're as much interested in whether or not they use tobacco as we are that they're willing to at least entertain the idea of quitting. And we do know from research that tobacco use is a leading cause of death in this country, and so that is something that we would like to help tackle.
How did you come up with the amounts for surcharges? $100 if you don't opt in, $75 for tobacco users.
Well, it's a great question. And, you know, again, we had a team of actuaries that looked at the probability of, you know, what percentage of the population were in these different categories based on our demographics. And those were the dollar amounts that we are applying that will help us reach the goal of not having an increase this year of more than 5%.
A couple of people have asked, will there be other surcharges in the future? Patrick actually sent us an email, and he asked, you know, motorcycle ownership, alcohol consumption, participation in extreme sports, should employees be expecting additional surcharges for what are considered lifestyle choices?
It's certainly not anything that we're talking about at this time.
Should Penn State employees expect more changes before the November open enrollment period?
We've actually provided most of the detail already. What's unfortunate is what's been picked up predominantly has been some of the things that people are not seeing as very positive. We actually have quite a bit of good news that's going to be coming as part of the initiative as well, which includes things like implementation of a qualified high deductible plan that will also have a health savings account that the university is going to seed with a certain amount of dollars. We haven't predetermined that yet, but those dollars will accumulate for employees in a health savings account that will be theirs. It will roll over year to year. It's completely portable if they leave the university, but those dollars will be there for them to spend on their deductibles and co-pays. We're also rolling out a values-based benefit initiative, which will mean that those individuals who have been who self-identify as having chronic health conditions such as diabetes, high blood pressure, we will, assuming they follow the medical protocol for their particular disease, we will actually be removing any barriers to their health care, meaning they will not have to pay the deductibles and co-pays. So there's more positive detail like that we'll be sharing with individuals when we actually hold our face-to-face meetings and also in upcoming open enrollment materials.
How would you address questions about privacy?
I think they're very valid concerns. You know, what I would want to ensure employees is that we are putting all the appropriate protocols in place to ensure that you know, anything that happens in an online environment is protected. And certainly any concerns that have been raised with WebMD, we are working with them. We feel very confident that they are a leading provider in this area. They are a partner of HIMARS, and it is a tool that will be used to collect the information.
Several people have asked why they are being required to give this information through third parties like WebMD and HIMARS instead of through their own trusted physician.
Well, it is just the tool that's being used to collect that information. Why, you know, we're not using, you know, we would not have access otherwise to get information from an individual's physician.
Are any aspects of what employees are filling out, like the wellness profile, biometric screening results, are any of these accessible to Penn State?
Absolutely not.
So right now, if everything is just based on people's voluntary information in the wellness profile, you're basically gathering information right now. Should employees expect that this will be used to create other surcharges in the future?
No. And you know, the purpose of the wellness profile is for it's for their use and for their benefit. We're doing they have the opportunity to do this completely free of charge. If they've been thinking about quitting, you know, the use of tobacco, we are providing free smoking cessation programs. Any of the their involvement with the biometric screenings, if they need to go to one of our clinics for that purpose, all of these things they can do on work time. So we're doing everything we can to promote and facilitate, you know, their successful access.
Here's a question we received from Steve via email. Is Penn State legally bound to this program? Have there been any contracts signed?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
I think the question is there any chance plans can still change based on employee feedback?
It's at this point, it's very unlikely, but it's mainly because I have a specific directive, I have a charge, I have a goal that I need to meet, and we've done lots and lots of work figuring out how best to meet that goal. And this helps us achieve that goal.
But you're not contractually obligated to fulfill this?
No.
If there are faculty members or local community members who want to question this plan and suggest other plans, would you be open to that conversation?
You know, anyone is within their rights to question, to raise dissent. Certainly nothing wrong with that. And certainly if anyone has any thoughts about how we can achieve that goal, you know, we certainly would not discount them by any stretch.
Susan Basso, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thanks, Kate.
That was Kate Lau Schaffner talking with Penn State's Vice President for Human Resources, Susan Basso. In the original interview, Basso incorrectly said information about who is a smoker will be taken from the WebMD wellness profile. Employees will actually have to attest to their tobacco use in their Employee Self-Service Information Center profile, commonly referred to as ESSIC. Penn State has no access to individual answers in the wellness profile. Speaking of healthcare, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has called community water fluoridation one of the great public health achievements of the 20th century. Meanwhile, critics say fluoridated water is not as safe and not as effective as we've been led to believe, and argue that consumers should have the right to choose. We invited both sides to discuss this issue. A representative from the Pennsylvania Dental Association accepted our invitation to be on the show and then later backed out. We also contacted the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection, the agency that oversees water fluoridation in the state. They declined our invitation. Why is water fluoridation controversial? Here to talk about that is Michael Connett, project director of the Fluoride Action Network, a group that opposes water fluoridation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Patty, for having me.
I did a random survey of colleagues in my office, and I have to be honest, not a single person I talked with had given even the slightest thought to water fluoridation. It was just not on their radar.
Well, yeah, I think fluoridation has become a bit of a blind spot in the United States. And there's a general view that fluoridation has just been an incredibly effective program. Like you said, the Centers for Disease Control calls it one of the top 10 public health achievements of the 20th century. But what many Americans don't realize is that most advanced countries have rejected fluoridation. So if you go to Europe, for example, 97% of the population does not drink fluoridated water. The health authorities in other countries have been far less enthusiastic about this program.
5.7% of the worldwide population has fluoridated water, as compared with 72% of American citizens drinking water that has added fluoride.
That's correct. And more people drink fluoridated water in the United States today than the rest of the world combined. So it's really not a common practice in the developed world, certainly.
There's some that Americans have better teeth as a result.
That's a frequently stated claim, but when you look at World Health Organization data by country, you see that the same decline in tooth decay that the United States has had over the past 50 or 60 years has been replicated in every single advanced country. Today, there is no difference in tooth decay between countries that have mass water fluoridation programs, like in the United States, and countries that don't have any fluoridation.
Like Japan, for example.
Like Japan and the Netherlands and Sweden and Germany. So the National Academy of Sciences has just published a report where they show that America actually ranks, I think, 13th in tooth decay rates amongst the Western world. So the United States, despite having a very massive fluoridation program, has not fared any better in terms of tooth decay rates.
Well, let me ask you this. If the Centers for Disease Control and the ADA, the American Dental Association, the AMA, the American Medical Association, the agencies charged with protecting public health, say water fluoridation is good policy, why should we question it?
Well, we should question it for a number of reasons. First, fluoridation is a very unique policy. It's the only medicine that we add to public water supplies. Fluoride is added to reduce tooth decay. And the Food and Drug Administration calls fluoride a medicine when used to prevent disease, and tooth decay is a disease. With all other medicines, it's the patient and not the doctor that gets to make the determination about what medicine to take. And that's why most of Western Europe has rejected fluoridation, because they didn't think the water supply is an appropriate way to deliver medicine. But then there's also the health concerns. And there are a number of studies in recent years that really raise significant concerns about fluoride's ability to affect many tissues in the body, not just the teeth. The whole focus in the United States to date has been fluoride and the teeth. But in 2006, the National Academy of Sciences published a comprehensive 500-page review of fluoride toxicity. And they found voluminous evidence showing that fluoride can affect the brain. Fluoride is an endocrine disruptor that can significantly impair thyroid and function. Fluoride can affect the pineal gland. And there are particular members in society that are especially vulnerable to fluoride's harm. So there's a lot of red flags today on the horizon about fluoride's effect on our health.
But if you look at the Centers for Disease Control website, they list the National Academy of Sciences as supporting fluoridation.
I don't know where they get that, but if you just look at the National Academy of Sciences report in 2006, it's fair to say it's the most comprehensive review of fluoride's toxicity that's really ever been done. They found that modestly elevated levels of fluoride, 2 or 3 times more than the average child would typically get today, can cause a range of serious effects, like reduced intelligence, reduced thyroid function. They also pointed out that there's really been a lack of adequate studies in the United States to look at how our current exposures to fluoride is affecting our health. And so they called on scientists in the United States to do the studies that really should have been done decades ago. For years, for about 40 to 50 years, independent scientists have called on government agencies to do a study to look at how fluoridation is affecting people with kidney disease, because we've known for many years that people with kidney disease are particularly vulnerable to suffering harm from fluoride because their body can't excrete the fluoride that they ingest. But there hasn't, till this day, despite 60 years of fluoridation, there hasn't been a single study to demonstrate that fluoridation is safe for people with kidney disease.
If you read articles about fluoride, and especially articles coming from the Centers for Disease Control, they say the issue is closed. We know that this prevents tooth decay, and it is safe for human health.
Yes, and that has been said for decades. Since as far back as the 1950s, you know, they said this is an issue that's beyond scientific debate. And you don't have to look much further than Dr. John Dewell, who is a very well-known toxicologist and was the scientist who chaired the NAS report in 2006, he stated in 2008 that we've gone with the status quo for too long on fluoride and that we have many basic questions about fluoridation safety that have not been settled. They're still unresolved. And he said we have far less data than we need. We really don't know what we need to know to make a determination of safety with fluoridation. And so the lack of studies should not be seen as proof of safety, which is what has been going on for years now.
Now,
and if you don't study something, if you don't look for harm, you're not going to find it.
Last year, the Federal Department of Health and Human Services revised the recommended level of fluoride in water to avoid the possibility that children would receive too much. The recommended level was 0.7 to 1.2 milligrams per liter. The department now says it should not exceed that lower end of that range. What do you make of the fact that they have lowered the acceptable level?
Well, it was good to see that they did that. In other countries that fluoridate their water, like in Ireland and Canada, they made that determination years ago to lower the fluoride levels. And they did that because everyone today is ingesting fluoride from many other sources besides tap water. When fluoridation first began, for example, back in 1945, there wasn't a single tube of toothpaste that contained fluoride. Today, over 95% of toothpaste contain fluoride, and studies show that young children can swallow a lot of fluoride just from their toothpaste and can, in fact, exceed the recommended total daily intake from just toothpaste alone. So the decision to lower the fluoride level in water is taking into account the fact that we now receive far more fluoride than we used to. And that's reflected in the fact that today the Centers for Disease Control has found that 41% of children now have a condition called dental fluorosis. And fluorosis is a staining of the teeth, usually white spots and streaks, but sometimes brown staining and tooth erosion that's caused by fluoride's interference with tooth-forming cells. So we're clearly getting a lot more fluoride than they ever expected we would. And that's, I think, a significant reason why we should be removing fluoride from the water supply.
You did mention that we may be getting fluoride in the food we eat. If the food is made from a fluoridated water source, there's fluoride in the food as well.
That's correct. And when you add fluoride to public water supplies en masse, you're not just adding it to the water, you're adding it to all those sodas and fruit drinks and beers that are made with the water, as well as the cereals and the processed foods that are made with the water. So in the United States today, studies show that our processed food chain is contaminated with elevated levels of fluoride, far higher than they were 50 to 60 years ago.
In the last 4 years, about 200 municipalities nationwide have stopped fluoridating the water, but many of those places ceased for financial, not for health reasons. I'm wondering what you expect to see in terms of tooth decay, though, as a result of that action.
Five studies published in the peer-reviewed literature in the past 10 years have found that tooth decay does not increase when fluoridation stops. So I don't expect to see any difference in tooth decay from removing fluoride from water.
Now, while 72% of Americans get their water from public systems that add fluoride, only 54% of Pennsylvania residents do. And dentists say that there is a silent crisis going on among Pennsylvania's poorest children. Their teeth are rotting. If not for fluoridation, what happens to especially inner-city children?
Well, I find this to be the most tragic aspect of the fluoridation program. I'm someone who believes in government health programs. And so the notion that fluoridation is a government health program to benefit low-income communities is something that on its face I find very appealing. But when you start digging beneath the surface, there are many very troubling aspects about this. First, poor communities need dental care. They need real dental care. They don't need cheap industrial chemicals in their water. What you find in low-income urban areas like Philadelphia and Pittsburgh and Cincinnati and New York and Boston is severe oral health crises taking place right now. But these communities have been fluoridated for 30, 40, 50 years.
Then how do you explain what the ADA says? Excuse me. They say the benefits of fluoridation are indisputable. In 1993, the ADA said the results of 113 studies in 23 countries were analyzed, and that the most frequently reported decay reductions observed were 40 to 49% for baby teeth and 50 to 59% for permanent teeth.
Well, the ADA has a longstanding vested interest in fluoridation. They're not a neutral party on this, and they've been adamantly promoting this for years. Fluoridation is also a very convenient policy for the ADA. Right now, there's efforts to allow dental therapists to provide affordable dental care to low-income populations, which is precisely what they need.
Dental hygienists, for example.
Yeah, dental hygienists who become autonomous and can treat patients without being under the rubric of a dentist. And studies show that they provide competent care, the drill and fill kind of operations that many people need. But the ADA has adamantly opposed these efforts. So they're denying real dental care, the kind of dental care that poor communities really need. And what makes it more serious, and this to me is one of my biggest concerns about fluoridation, is this. We know that people who have poor nutrition and who have poor health, like kidney disease, we know that they are far more vulnerable to fluoride's toxic effects. And these are the populations that you're precisely going to see in poor communities. And because they're poor, they don't have any ability to avoid the fluoride once you put it in the water. And it provides this false notion that we're doing something to tackle these difficult problems that we face with no access to dentists.
What do you say then when pro-fluoridation groups call those against it unscientific, fear-mongers, crackpots, even evil, among other things?
Well, I would just say, do they think that about Germany? Do they think that about Netherlands, Sweden, Denmark, Norway, Italy, France? I mean, these are advanced, developed countries with sophisticated health agencies, each of which have rejected fluoridation. So the notion that it's unreasonable to oppose fluoridation is quite frankly, just silly. A few years ago, for example, I interviewed a Nobel laureate in medicine, Dr. Arvid Carlson, who won a Nobel Prize for his work on neuroscience. And he was the scientist in Sweden that convinced the parliament to not fluoridate their water. So in the United States, we kind of have tunnel vision on this issue. We only look to American health authorities, and we only look at our own experience. We don't look at the broader experience in the Western world. And if we did look at that broader view, we would see that fluoridation has been hyped up and exaggerated for so many years. And it's really time for us to take a sober look at this policy. You know, I would just summarize it by saying this. What makes more sense? To put fluoride in toothpaste, most toothpaste now has fluoride in it, or to add it to everyone's water? With toothpaste, you allow each person the right to decide whether they want to use fluoride or whether they don't. And you also minimize the ingestion of fluoride, which is where the risks come from. And that's important because we now know today that fluoride's primary benefit to teeth comes from topical application, direct contact with the teeth. So you don't actually need to swallow fluoride to get its benefit. So if we don't need to swallow fluoride to get its main benefit, why are we still adding it to water?
Michael Connett, we are out of time. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Patty. I really appreciate it.
That was Michael Connett, project director of the Fluoride Action Network, a group that opposes water fluoridation. To hear other interviews in the Take Note series, check the links on our website, wpsu.org/take note. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.